back to order. We are on item six, salts and nutrients in groundwater, considerations for regulatory actions, and we have Jeremiah Puget.
Thank you, Vice Chair Minton. Members of the board, it's my pleasure to speak to you today. I am Jeremiah Puget, Senior Environmental Scientist of your staff for the Groundwater Protection Division. So we will be talking about salt and nutrients in groundwater and going over the considerations, regulatory considerations. Is my mic on, Donna?
It doesn't. That mic has never worked that well. This one works way better.
Okay. So, give you a little bit of a purpose of today. We're going to go through an explanation of the various levels and concentrations of water quality objectives related to salts and nutrients in groundwater. We'll now also explain how permit limitations are developed for salts and nutrients, as well as providing some basin-wide groundwater data analysis for a few of our higher priority basins to establish some background concentrations and existing conditions and trends. Today's presentation, here's an outline. I'll do a brief overview defining the narrative and numeric objectives and some recent revisions that we made to the basin plan. Then I'll walk through the same topic, but give you a conceptual illustration of the objectives and anti-degradation and limitations. And then we'll take a more in-depth look at some of the nitrate and total dissolved solid objectives. There's some things to tease out and some of the trends that I promised in our basins. And we'll wrap it up with some examples of some effluent and receiving water limitations that we've put before this board for adoption. So, water quality objectives are the limits, levels, water quality constituents, or characteristics that established for the reasonable protection of beneficial uses of water or the prevention of nuisance within a specific area. They come in two forms, numeric and narrative, although some of our objectives, such as chemical constituents, are hybrids. They contain both a narrative objective and numeric ones. With our recent amendment to Chapter 3 of the Basin Plan for Water Quality Objectives, we cleaned up the language a little bit to be more explicit in how we develop those discharge limitations and the cleanup levels. We added some specifics, actually some statements, from Port Cologne. The Regional Water Board, in setting waste discharge requirements, will consider, among other things, the potential impacts of the beneficial uses, the area of influence of the discharge, the appropriate water quality objectives, the existing quality of the receiving waters, in this case groundwater, and the anti-degradation policy. It's really important, additionally, to point out that, in the quote from Porter Cologne, in setting discharge limitations and cleanup levels, the board need not authorize the utilization of the full assimilative capacity of the waters, and may adopt more limits, more stringent, in order to preserve high-quality waters. So let's take a look at this in a different way. Saying the same thing, but looking at it slightly different. So the anti-degradation policy is really the lower limit. Sometimes we refer to it as background or natural background because we do have naturally occurring salts and nutrients. And the water quality objectives are that upper limit to protect the beneficial uses. So there is some space that we could call assimilative capacity. The water quality objectives really define the upper limit of the assimilative capacity in comparison to the existing quality of water. And for every particular constituent, it's going to vary. Here's another look at it. So again, to reiterate the importance of assimilative capacity, I just want to restate that the board need not authorize the full use of the water's assimilative capacities. And it's in this context that you can see for each permitted pollutant load or even unpermitted point sources, we are taxing that assimilative capacity. And with respect to the quality of waters throughout the North Coast region, we really are in a fortunate situation. We do have some things that we can learn from the Central Valley and the Central Coast. And that's why you've heard us say it many times now with that mantra of an ounce of prevention. So let's dive in a little bit more specifically into the nutrient objective we're talking about, particularly for nitrate. So Nitrate is a regulated drinking water contaminant with an established maximum contaminant level of 10 milligrams per liter as nitrogen. That's currently what we use. I point out this difference because you might see a lot of information that's reported as nitrate is NO3, and the former maximum contaminant level of 45 was widely used. And really, I want to point out that that's not two separate sources of nitrate or two different kinds of or species of nitrate. That's essentially just different measurement units. And there's a simple conversion factor to get you from one to the other, but currently we're all going with the 10 milligrams per liter. It's a little more easier to just compare with numbers. And that MCL is intended to protect pregnant women and infants from blue baby syndrome, a condition that actually affects the body's ability to carry oxygen in the bloodstream, and it can be fatal. So when we're determining limitations, I'm going to walk you through this process. It's one of my favorite things. So watch out, that's the nerd you're dealing with. Site-specific concentrations and discharge information is where we start, and then we look at what water bodies may be affected. Again, I'm primarily talking about groundwater for this topic. And then we look at what are those beneficial uses. We have 6 beneficial uses listed in the basin plan for groundwater, but primarily we're going to be talking about municipal and domestic drinking water supplies and agricultural supplies for irrigation. Those are actually generally the most, in most circumstances, the most sensitive of the two beneficial uses. What are the water quality objectives to protect those uses? Again, we have numeric and narrative, and the water quality standards are from the applicable control plans, and that takes into account statewide plans and policies that may either supersede or work in conjunction with our basin plan. This is all one flow chart as I move to the next page, but just for the ease of looking at it, we're chopping it up into two. So again, we're looking at our applicable numeric objectives and the applicable narrative objectives. There's another step when it comes to the narratives, is that we have to find a numeric value that implements that narrative. And those values are based on either other agencies like the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment, or the latest and greatest science and literature review available. But we usually go, we're always relying on very trusted sources of information. Once we compare the narrative and the numeric, we're actually then going to choose the most limiting value. What that means is the narrative more, or is that value less than our numeric? Again, making it more complex, but this is the way it works. We also have to consider anti-degradation, which adds that site-specific background of water quality. 1968 is when the policy was established. And then we compare that, existing quality of water or the beneficial uses, and from that we get an output of a limiting value that is protective of all those beneficial uses. So we've done a little bit of that. I kind of noticed a parallel with what Chris Kerrigan was talking about earlier in his discussion of consistency in a process. So we definitely have a parallel there with the consistency in a process that does have the potential, as Chris stated, to come out with a different outcome in an individual circumstance. So, sources of nitrate, fertilizers, septic systems, animal and human wastes. Organic sources of nitrogen, if not uptaken by plants, and really the end point in most anaerobic environments is nitrate. So that's, again, why we're focusing on nitrate as a constituent of concern. And to say that it's only a Central Valley problem is not entirely accurate. We have some situations here in the North Coast, as you can see, where we have public water supply wells that have exceeded the maximum contaminant level for nitrate. In a variety of locations all throughout the region. And this isn't actually a complete list of all the exceedances, but it's the most recent representative of the past 10 years. So this data that you're looking at here was actually taken from our Groundwater Ambient Monitoring Assessment Database, our GAMMA program, and that database includes public water supply systems, so local water purveyors that that assessment that's required for the distribution of public supply of drinking water and all that analysis is available, those results are available. As well as the Department of Pesticide Regulation, the entire Department of Water Resources data library, as well as a number of USGS special studies and some other domestic well sampling projects. We have the ability to turn on a layer that shows our monitoring well information in this, but when we're doing an ambient assessment, we have a tendency not, we really don't include that because that skews the information on a baseline as far as what the regional conditions are towards contamination. So we like to take our first screen with just this subset of the available data. So I'm going to walk you through the region a little bit. Let's start with the land of Del Norte, where I hail from. Mom and Dad's house right there in Washington. Favorite surf spot right there. Just wanted to point that out. And the beautiful crown jewel, the Smith River, coming through in there. You've got Smith River Plain up in that area. So when you're looking at these concentrations, the top graph, what I want to emphasize is that those are average concentrations through the decade. So we're compiling all that information and giving you some averages. The graph below are the individual samples of nitrate. It's the same data set. It's just representing it. So you can see that while we look at it on a whole in the basin, and we don't particularly see a trend of alarm, we can identify localized hot spots. One other thing to point out, don't strain too hard on trying to see this, but there are color coding systems in this database that indicate green is for very low to non-tech concentrations. Our yellows are for concentrations that are we have a higher detection level, but it's not quite halfway to the maximum contaminant level. Orange is above, and then the red, of course, is that. So we're not really going to isolate any particular discharge or location in this presentation today. Yeah, so
Jeremiah, just there's an obvious jump between the decades of 70 and 80. Have you been able to go back and determine what changed at that time to cause that 2.5-fold increase over the course of that decade?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one of our members of the groundwater team, when we were taking a look at this data, actually asked a fascinating question, because this basin, as we know, is much different than the geology we have here that we're over at the moment, and it's kind of a shallow alluvium system. A lot of the wells there, typically domestic water supply wells, municipal water supply wells are rather deep, but in this system, they're actually rather shallow. So we consider it kind of a shallow bowl that could be affected dramatically by precipitation. And we know that Del Norte County gets a pretty large share of precipitation. And so what we did is actually go back in time and charted a couple of different weather stations that were available. There was two different data points, and we found a really interesting pattern and correlation between the rise and fall of those nitrate concentrations and increases in precipitation. So right after the 70s, or towards the end of the 70s and in the beginning of the 80s, particularly 1980, very dry year up there. And we couldn't help but notice that there was a little bit of similarity there. All right, so moving on, further on down to the Eel River Valley, we see interesting low concentrations on average of nitrate without actually any individual samples exceeding that maximum contaminant level. These concentrations that you're looking around on average are concentrations that are around 1 milligram per liter. That can be background. That can naturally occur. Anything you see above that is likely an anthropogenic signal. So this slide again is the this map is showing the public water supply data. I've zoomed in now from 2012 to 2016 because we're comparing it with another data set that is predominantly of more shallow wells in the system. And so the point here is that there are some exceedances in some of the shallow zones, and what it tells us is that this system, this database, and how we screen is that there's always a little bit more, and it doesn't always paint the exact picture of what a particular basin is, what's going on. There's always more to dive in to a little bit deeper. Heading down further throughout the region, working our way to our office here, we're in Ukiah now. And This is an interesting story when we look at, again, relatively low concentrations of nitrate. I don't have any actual exceedances of drinking water, but what I'm comparing this now to these bars that you see right here are secondary and tertiary treatment levels of water. This little bar right there, that's actually this one right here, 0.7, that's the gamma data, that's the ambient data that we have throughout. These are actually wells that are monitoring the ponds that hold this water. So we don't really see, on average, any kind of impact from that. But nonetheless, looking at these concentrations, it definitely supports the fact that we need to have monitoring programs to watch these changes over time and consider our limitations when doing so. I will come back to this when we're talking about salts later on. It has a little bit of a different story. And finally, getting, if you go to the east, the west, a little dyslexic at the moment, and the source of some of the water I've got with me right now from Sebastopol, we see it actually we see a little bit of a different trend. And so this one stands out to us a little bit, and so we actually tore the data apart a little bit differently in that we wanted to, because when we did the bar charts, it was very blurry in here, and we couldn't necessarily see that there really are a lot of concentrations that of sample results that are much further below the contaminant level, but we do have a pretty good share of those that are above, well above, and I think the trend's pretty clear when we look at that. Just to dive into that data a little bit more, because whenever we see something that's slightly alarming or concerning, we want to understand it a bit more. So if you actually look through how we've sliced up the decades here, these are the number of samples that are over the maximum contaminant level as compared to the total number of samples. So if we're just comparing percentages, we do see that really from the 60s to 80s, we didn't necessarily have it, we did not have any exceedances. And we do have a jump up. Again, we're seeing the percentage of those samples that are exceeding that MCL as declining. So to cover the nitrate limitation again, and putting it in the context of our permits, most of our permits establish a groundwater limitation and a discharge limitation right at the maximum contaminant level. However, there may be some discharges that we allow that are higher in concentration, higher than that, and in that, it's because we're taking into account the soil profile and the treatment or the potential agronomic rate or the uptake of nitrogen by plants as that water makes its way to groundwater. And so we rely on that type of assessment a lot when we're permitting certain discharges. On the salts now. Any questions on the data that we've covered thus far? Great. So on the salts, typically measured as total dissolved solids, there are several different ways that we can measure salts, and you can really unpack total dissolved solids a lot too, and I'll get a bit more into that. But here's the concentrations that you would see typically in some areas. Precipitation very low, freshwater streams fairly low. We can have some impacts to agricultural crops at a concentration of around 450 milligrams per liter. And the brines and groundwater can have these large ranges depending on local variation. Sources of salinity include natural geology. And most salts don't degrade, and they can remain in groundwater. The economic cost of increased groundwater and surface water salinity throughout the entire state of California has manifested in fallow farmland, unsuitable drinking water, and environmental degradation, and that can be estimated in the millions of dollars annually on a statewide basis. So salinity can, as I mentioned, include many different ions. However, relatively few make up what we consider total dissolved solids. That includes chloride, fluoride, sulfate, sodium, potassium, and the others that you see up here. And phosphate also can contribute to total dissolved solid concentrations. Now, moving on to the salinity objectives, this is where it gets a little bit more complex, and there's a number of reasons for that. And so here we have the secondary maximum contaminant level that is established in Title 22. This is our chemical constituents objective. So what this is pointing to the numeric values that are protected for the beneficial use, but you have this range both for TDS, chloride, and sulfate. It's recommended upper and short term. So it's essential to note, though, that these values, the upper and the short term, are generated for the Division of Drinking Water, formerly California Department of Public Health. What we really need to note is that the impact to the beneficial use, taste, odor, and nuisance occurs at these concentrations. The upper concentration, and I'll read it directly from the regulations, are levels that are acceptable if it is neither reasonable nor feasible to provide more suitable water. So that regulation really pertains to the Division of Drinking Water, because at concentrations that are lower, we are seeing an adverse impact. As far as the short term, that goes all the way up to 1,500 or 600 for chloride and sulfate, we see that it's only acceptable if an existing community water system, on a temporary basis, pending the construction of treatment facilities or new sources of water. So just to point that out, it really underscores the point that, this is where the impact to the beneficial use of municipal and domestic supply is happening. But as I mentioned, it depends on the speciation and the local variability. So you could have a concentration of TDS that maybe wasn't at 500, but just a portion of that, one of the ions, chloride, sulfate, could be at concentrations that were 250, and that will impact the beneficial use. So you could even have a lower concentration of potent dissolved solids, but the impact to the beneficial use occurs because of the particular speciation that we're dealing with. So let's look at our, and this is our numeric objective. Let's look at our narrative. And this is the narrative objective. Groundwater shall not contain concentrations of chemical constituents in amounts that cause nuisance or adversely affect beneficial uses. Whoa, more numbers. So let's make some sense of this. Again, I made the point pretty clear about the recommended values for our numeric values coming out of Title 22. What's really important, though, to note is that these are, to the left on this side, we have the numeric values implementing our narrative objectives. I'm getting very specific in legal terminology there, because it's important to note that, as I showed you, the narrative objective is a statement, but these are the values that are derived from either other industries or agencies or literature review. And I'd like to point out the agricultural impacts are derived from Water Quality from Agriculture, a report developed in 1976 and amended in 1985 and also amended in 1994, developed by University of California, Davis, and a senior scientist from the Central Valley Water Quality Control Board. So we consider that some robust and reliable data to indicate that agricultural impacts actually occur at 450 to sensitive crops. But let's look at chloride again, too. So if I'm pointing out that total dissolved solids can go up to 500, chlorides at 250, this is where our taste and odor can be impacted. This is where municipal, domestic can be impacted. But if we're talking about irrigating crops, we have a much lower concentration that we are finding as our limiting value.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How is it that you prioritize these ions in your presentation? Is it for human health, agricultural impact, or use, or expected contamination from tertiary water?
Well, when we're looking at the beneficial uses, it's just going back to that table that I was walking through. It's a great question, and
because I don't see manganese or boron.
Well, why we chose, well, yeah, excellent question. I could go into the details of those. The reason that we chose these is because these are typically ones that we're looking at when we're permitting some of our discharges. TDS has just been a pollutant that we have relied on for quite some time. There's a decent amount of information about it, and the same can be said with chloride. But point well taken, and those constituents that you mentioned there too, go through the same process of when we're looking at our narrative values versus our numeric. As far as prioritizing for this, the purpose of this presentation, there's actually, if I recall correctly, I don't think that there is a numeric value for boron in Title 22. Don't quote me on that, but I'll double check and follow up with you on that. But I do know that we have some values coming out of those narrative literature reviews that we would implement our narrative through. So that was one of the reasons, is that specifically Title 22 lists out some of these. We have sodium here for an example, and it's actually not listed at all in Title 22. So it's kind of comparable to that, where there, while there's no list in that part of the regulation, this is where we can implement our narrative regulation and find values that are protective of both taste and odor for municipal uses and irrigation through agriculture. So when we're making that decision, you see that actually in this instance, taste and odors is more sensitive than agricultural impacts. So if we were going to choose a limiting value, it would be in that range. Does that help answer the question a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. So let's go back up to the top and to start at the Smith River again. And here we see the concentrations of total dissolved solids. Again, these are the averages throughout the decade, and here are the individual concentrations. When we look at this, nothing really jumps out as too alarming. When we move down to the Eel River, we see a little bit more fluctuation and variability. We do see some instances of some exceedances. We do know also that there's been a lot of work towards assessing, and I frankly didn't include the data in here for the saltwater intrusion, but I know that we have some interests in how that was defined in the past, and there's been a lot of work to define that line of, and you can almost see it where there's no drinking water supply wells is the extent of the intrusion, save for these couple that actually did have some spikes up over in this area. Going back to Ukiah, as I mentioned, there was something I wanted to show you there, and it tells a little bit of a different story when we're talking about salts in Ukiah Valley. The same situation, the same treatment, the same water that I was showing you the nitrate concentrations for, but the reactions in the nearby monitoring wells are very different as compared to our baseline that we're gathering from averaging our water supply wells, as well as looking at some of the individual concentrations. This kind of stands out to us a little bit. And then back to the Wilson Grove formation, we see again with this one a similar trend as we saw with the nitrates. So it places a little bit of emphasis that some more thought and some more careful investigation is necessary. So now that we have a bit of background information, let's shift gears and look at some of the examples of some recent permits that we've developed and why we recommended the values that we did for those requirements. Here's an individual WDR that came before the board years past, where we were looking at the upgrading concentrations of the facility ranging from 290 to 360. That's fairly comparable to those averages that we were showing you on a grander scale, the basin-wide scale. So always when looking at a site-specific instance, it's good to keep the context of your basin scale, but it's also good to then look more localized and find what's directly upgrading of the discharge. The numeric value for total dissolved solids, as I went over, is 500, and as I detailed TDS for the narrative, implementation of our narrative objective, we go with 450. So that's why we would recommend 450 as a limit for total dissolved solids. Because if we actually look at the concentration of discharge, we have a range from 350 to 1,200, but the average is actually 863. I compared that to the median, too, and that's 860, so high level of confidence that 863 is actually representative of that average concentration of discharge. So there you have it when we're coming up with a recommendation of either increasing monitoring frequency or networks or coming up with that effluent limitation, that's why we're going to make the recommendation of that. It's just the logic flow that we go through when we're establishing those limitations for your consideration. Now moving on to our general WDR for wine, beverage, and food processors. In this instance, we took exactly the same wise logic moving through it, but I'm using chloride here as an example. And our background concentrations of chloride throughout the entire region range greatly from half a milligram per liter to 687. On the basin that we're sitting above right now, that actually ranges from 5 to about 180. So there's a lot of variation. Up in Healdsburg, I think it goes from somewhere like 10 to 30, very low actually, as far as typical concentrations. So back to that slide that I showed you, our numeric objectives for our taste and odor threshold, protective of our municipal supplies, are 250. However, in order to keep agriculture sustainable and into the future, It's a much lower number of 106, and so that's why we have the recommended chloride limit that was adopted that is much lower of 106. So as you can see, we don't have much in the way of a characterization of the variety of discharges from wineries, food processors, and beverage processors that we really don't have a great idea of the we know there's a large variation, but it's kind of hard to represent. And we don't have a lot of great down gradient monitoring of that. So it just underscores the point of why we're going to be requiring more monitoring for programs like this into the future. And why it's so crucial that we do put in those types of requirements, even though sometimes folks, when we're rolling out a new permit, you know, they kind of feel the squeeze a little bit initially. It's, why are we now having to look for this? I thought you had high quality groundwater. Well, we do. That's the way we like it. So the key points that I want the board to come away with today is that effluent and groundwater limitations and monitoring requirements and permits, they are the foundation of our protection efforts. And water quality standards, when you're looking at beneficial uses to objectives to the anti-degradation policy, especially in site-specific contexts, are complex. And determining those effluent limitations and those monitoring requirements does indeed take careful consideration and judgment on staff's part. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Any questions or comments from the board?
So for the chlorine, when you have a background amount of 687 and we set the limit at 106, what do we do with something like that?
Well, that's why with the anti-degradation policy takes that kind of local variation into consideration. It's that in that type of an instance, it's a kind of a complex situation where really the beneficial uses might not be attainable at that location. In this specific instance, 687 is not necessarily the greatest representation of what we see throughout the region. That's why I mentioned that in other areas, particularly where we're at right now, are much lower. What I gain from that is that we just really need to drill down, literally and figuratively, into the matter a little bit more and figure out what may be happening. But that does come into play when we're considering limitations. So it's, it's complex, and I hate to throw out a general answer for all situations when you can see that it can be hard to assess those particular instances without a real good example. So that's why we chose.
So we have a customer who comes to us, and they just happen to be in one of these bad areas, and we just work with them, and we look at that's the background, and there's nothing they can do about it, then we just write that into the waste discharge that they don't... That they're exempt from that part of it?
Well, it also depends on what type of discharge we're looking at. Are we looking at this as from the angle of a water supply? Is this something that we're looking at for drinking water? Or is this zone something that we're looking at as a, as a basin that has already undergone a lot of accumulation and degradation? So it would be interesting to then dig back in and look at whether or not this is, say, a condition of a fault or some type of interesting natural geology, or is this the result of years of heavy land use? So we still have to tease it apart at that level too. It's an excellent question. I kind of anticipated that somebody would ask that question, putting that number up there.
So it's what if that's a natural background or if it's a man-made background?
Yeah.
So
And to be honest with you, that concentration, I still need to dig in a little bit more. I actually noted that 687 did come from up in Siskiyou County. But when we look at Siskiyou County as a whole, it has a tendency not necessarily to have that high a concentration, which may indicate there's actually some kind of unique geological feature or some other type of fouling that we really don't know. But again, it kind of underscores the point of we do this initial screening to kind of focus our priorities and the decisions that we're making, but then also when we're looking at that sort of a concentration, we do have some tough calls to make. It's kind of similar to when we're dealing with, say, arsenic that's naturally occurring in areas that you really can't do anything about other than treat it at the wellhead. There are some conditions that you can with arsenic that you can get into that'll make it more anaerobic and release more, but you know, again, kind of some complex situations.
When you're evaluating hills and valleys in rises and falls of certain elements, mm-hmm. do you look at, or do you have data available as to what fertilizers were sold in different regions? Mm-hmm. For example, potassium chloride mm-hmm. is very inexpensive compared to potassium sulfate, mm-hmm. and it could be a source for chloride. I know if we overuse it in the vineyards, we get chloride toxicity.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, this great observation, and I guess the most recent example I have of that is working with some of our staff who are working up in the Tule Lake Basin for that permit. And we were looking at phosphate concentrations, orthophosphate, that sort of thing. So most definitely when we're looking at it as either a site-specific issue or a basin-wide issue, we most definitely want to be aware of those types of discharges or land applications that are coming into play. It's kind of what you're getting at there is, in some instances, kind of the next step. It really is after we screen the data, rather than putting that level of intensity into it. We don't see that that's necessary in some locations, but maybe we do need to start teasing that out in some of the other locations. So, yeah, great recommendations.
The apple growers have a history of putting on 200 pounds per acre of nitrogen fertilizer.
Right, and when we've looked at the salt and nutrients for Santa Rosa Plain, that's the only area that we've actually had a really robust stakeholder-produced plan, and we worked really closely, or that group worked really closely with the vineyards and dairy operators to get an idea of how much was actually being applied to kind of model and estimate what could be happening. But unfortunately, in some cases, with respects to nutrients, there's a big distinction between manure and then fertilizers, but the signals and a lot of the science and the evaluation that we've seen too are rather complex. So they don't always match up with the assumptions that you would make off of that type of application. Just, you know, adding more to the complexity of the situation, why we need to take such a careful look.
Board member questions or comments? Thank you, Jeremiah. Do we have any comment cards? Are there any members of the public who are interested in commenting, who didn't turn in cards? Okay, well, thank you very much. And we will move to item 7, an update on the industrial